This is an ABC podcast.
Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone on RN. I'm David Rutledge, and this is the fifth and final program in our series, Philosophy in the Wake of Empire. We're looking at the ways in which the West's history of colonial expansion has influenced the shape of philosophy, the notion of what counts as philosophy, and who counts as a philosopher. Over the past few weeks, we've looked at Europe, Asia, Africa. This week, we're bringing it back home.
There's been a great debate around what constitutes philosophy, and I think that because the West has always seen itself as, holding that knowledge production domain, it has fundamentally dismissed other ways of seeing and being in the world. And yet, if, you start reading around in philosophy itself and you can see that the Greek philosophers like Plato and Socrates were also influenced by Chinese, they're influenced by African thinkers. Like, it's not the origins of philosophy. And this, I think, goes to Foucault's point when he says there is no originality in terms of where we are because we always are building on those that have gone before us. And I think it's one of the ways in which race has played out in philosophy. The notion that white Western and patriarchal knowledge is fundamentally what constitutes philosophy.
Aileen Morton Robinson is Indigenous Elder Scholar in Residence at RMIT University in Melbourne. She lives on Stradbroke Island, which is off the coast of Brisbane. And when this interview was recorded, we were sitting in Aileen's kitchen, looking back at the mainland where the air was thick with the smoke of dozens of huge bushfires. Prime Minister Scott Morrison had just been on the radio saying that there was no direct link between Australia's greenhouse gas emissions and the bushfires. And it was an interesting context in which to be talking about the production of knowledge and the question of who gets to define the parameters of credible discourse. Aileen Morton Robinson's philosophical education began very early in her life, and it didn't have a lot to do with Plato, Kant, or Hegel. It was about tracking in the bush.
Well, my grandfather would take us and teach us about the prints in the sand and what animal made it. And tracking in sand is one of the most difficult things because the grains of sand fall particular ways. And so to know whether a snake crossed the path, left to right or right to left, all had to do with the way the grains fell. So what he, to me, was doing was basically cementing in us the realisation that we needed to be extremely observant about where we were and that the place in which we were was full of everything that was alive. So you were never separate from where you were. You were fundamentally connected to it. And tracking was a way of I felt as a child, of focus and understanding things like all the things that you need to get a kangaroo. You have to know what they eat, what time of day they come out, where the wind's blowing in order to, if you want to get it, you've got to know that so that it can't smell you. So there's all kinds of things that you have to learn about the animal that is just not about seeing the animal.
So what's the connection then between Aileen Morton Robinson today and little Aileen, those years ago, learning tracking on Stradbroke Island? Have you carried that learning with you into your professional life in some way?
Absolutely. For me, I guess, as a methodology for operating, what it does is it means that if I want to capture something, then I have to know as much as I can about it. So for me, going to university was fundamentally about trying to not just understand the content of a discipline and what it's, say in sociology, like who are the main theorists and learning their theories, but it was really to also understand what underpinned the theory, right? And I guess my when I got to uni, I realised that I thought differently was when I was asked to do my first assignment. And I was asked to produce a 1,000-word essay for prehistory. And I couldn't answer the question under 6,000 words. And even then I felt I couldn't answer it. So I really thought there was something wrong with me. So I went, and there was no Indigenous centre at the ANU at that time. And so the closest was the non-English speaking group. So I thought, well, I might go and make an appointment to see what's wrong with me in relation to answering this question. And her name was Bridget Ballard, the lady that I went to see. And Bridget read it and just said to me, this is brilliant. What's the problem? And I said, oh, no, well, it's not. I said, because I can't get it under 6,000 words and I've only got to do 1,000. And so Bridget said to me, well, you know what the problem is, don't you, Aileen? And I went, no. And she said, well, you're trying to show the relationships between everything, when in actual fact, being at university means to categorise, separate, distinguish, right? So it's a totally opposite way of thinking, which meant I then had to understand that I thought differently and I had to kind of hold on to myself, if I can say that, whilst I immersed myself in the university and the disciplinary knowledges that I chose to participate in.
That sense of unease or being wired differently, I mean, that started early for you as well, because I know you've spoken of starting your school education and experiencing what you call ontological disturbance. Mm. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about? What was that about, that ontological disturbance?
Oh, it was about basically like, you know, learning to think in a way, like learning 1 + 1 = 2. Like, so there's this sense in which you come into a world where you've come from a community home environment where everything's connected, right? That's how people operate. Then you go into a world that separates things, right? And you come from what I call, you know, it's more like you think in continuums when it's relational, right, instead of binaries. And so to go into a system then that was, you know, had binary logics about using the English language, like learning grammar, like used to do my head in, and having to accept that there was a separation. There was like the full stop on the end of these things, which wouldn't have occurred and doesn't occur at home, in the sense that I think what you learn when you have a kind of a relational frame is that certainty is never really there, because you become aware of the sense that you can't know everything. You're taught that different people are knowledge holders in different ways, but you also understand you can't know everything. And then you go to university, which is trying to tell you you can know everything. See, and I was having these moments in the classroom at school and then having it again when I went to uni. But what I knew, I learnt at uni, was more about the Western system. So it really enabled me to understand why I had those moments where I knew there was something wrong or going on, but I couldn't explain it.
The ontological disturbance cuts both ways though, doesn't it? Because mm-hmm. you've said that white Australians are ontologically disturbed by the presence of Indigenous people. What exactly do you mean by that?
I think that the presence of Indigenous peoples calls forth in the subconscious the fact that this land is not theirs, okay? There's the history in this country, of which people probably know more about now, but I do think that our bodies disturb, because we're reminders of unfinished business. You know, we still don't have a treaty. And what underpins that at a very ontological level is that idea that this is not Britain, this is Aboriginal people's country, this is Gurrumpul country, this is Warlpu, this is et cetera, et cetera. And that our connection to it is not in the same way that white fellows relate to it. It's not that we can't understand that. We've been made to understand it, forced to understand it. So the ontological disturbance, I think, is much for us as it is with them. But I will say that for Indigenous people, we have to fundamentally learn to tolerate your difference. In fact, we have to become quite expert about it. But white Australia doesn't have to really understand our difference. And that's the way that power operates in this society.
But that's a nice reversal, isn't it? Because difference is always the domain of the other, in white Australia in particular. And we were talking earlier about the way in which race isn't really spoken of in this country very skillfully or even at all in some respects. And I wonder if you think that that's partly because to talk about race would mean to talk about whiteness. Mm-hmm. And whiteness is sort of strategically invisible in Australia. Mm. People get very upset if you start to point the finger and say, well, this, that and the other because you're white.
Yeah. Well, it's an invisibility because, right, you know, the whole construction of race has been on blackness, right, not on whiteness. And yet whiteness has constructed blackness as its opposition. Yeah. And in Australia, the way in which race has played out has been through legislation or policy. It has never been an area, a field of intellectual endeavour, and we have to ask why that may be so, whereas every other former British colony has critical race studies or race studies in its universities. That's still yet to happen here in 2020. And because of that, all that white Australians can do is feel very threatened by the call to whiteness and feel very threatened, defensive, fragile when we want to talk about race. And that's because they respond emotionally and they're angry about it. So there's that stuff around, you know, displacement occurs where, you know, like I can speak very nicely to people and they'll just get up and say, you're just really angry. And then I kind of say, well, actually, no, you're angry that I'm saying this. You need to own that, right? Don't put that on me when it's you that are angry because of what I've said. You know, take responsibility for your emotional response, right? So it's because, you know, whiteness has never seen itself as being racialized, because those who racialize it aren't in power, it can invisibilize itself. Sorry, I just, you know, so those kind of moments for a lot of us black fellas is just like, you know, it is, we just kind of laugh because it's like, how can you not know that, you know, how can you not know that you're white?
This is The Philosopher's Zone. You're listening to it on RN with me, David Rutledge, and my guest is the author and scholar, Aileen Morton Robinson. We're talking about race and power and the long shadow that colonial Australia continues to cast over Indigenous communities and Indigenous forms of knowledge.
How do these conversations play out within the academy, not so much with your students, but with your academic peers? Because if you look at your sort of typical humanities academic, if such a thing exists, I mean, these are people who are would say that they're politically progressive for the most part, that they're concerned about racial issues in Australia, Indigenous issues, that they're seekers of justice in the Enlightenment tradition. Do you find that even there is this sort of invisible whiteness and this kind of resistance to the sort of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, because whiteness is not just about white bodies, right? It's fundamentally tied up in the very conditions that produces white Western culture. So that, you know, humanity scholars are not going to be outside of it. You know, I offered to teach an anti-racism subject to pre-service teachers at QUT, and that subject didn't get in because the curriculum was too full, right? So we haven't been able to crack like a major in race studies anywhere in any university because it is perceived as something that shouldn't be taught, yet it has a whole tradition, it's an intellectual field of endeavour for over a century now, a century and a half, but it's not taught here. And so someone like me is always seen as a problem because I really haven't got time to educate white people about their whiteness, and not when I'm trying to push forward policy issues or I'm dealing, you know, at the Indigenous higher education area for trying to bring about reform, because I've always been quite aware of time. You know, one of the things in Western culture that's quite to the fore is that death only is a reality unless someone dies in your family, or when you start getting around 50 or 60, you might start thinking about the fact that you're going to go. But death is not a part of your living, right? Whereas death is a part of your living as an Indigenous person. So we want to change things. And we know we don't have a great deal of time to change things, right? But what you come up against is it can always be put off till tomorrow.
Is it also about the, I was going to say the fact, I mean, we can talk about whether it is a fact, but it was stated on this program a few weeks ago that the Australian university system is a colonial project from the ground up, right? And if you agree with that, then the commitment that you have to establishing and elevating Indigenous knowledges within the academy, increasing the access, university access to Indigenous people, if the university system is still sort of all hung about with these vestiges of colonialism, that must be a very frustrating project because you're trying to gain access for people into a system which is really not amenable, really not suited in some ways.
Oh, it is. I mean, it is extremely frustrating, but it goes back to the methodology, it goes back to the tracking, right? So if you want to change it, you have to know everything you can about it and you have to try and change from within. What I actually, for the future, and I won't see it in my lifetime, but I would love for an Indigenous university to be established in Australia, for all Australians, where we're in control of our knowledge production and we are the ones that set up our ethics, we are the ones that set up our practices, we are the ones that are defining what we believe is knowledge. And I'm hopeful that will happen. But, yes, it is extremely frustrating to be, you know, it is another, every day is a day in the colony though. It's not just at university, it's everywhere that we go.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about post-colonial theory and diaspora identity because that's something that comes up a lot in post-colonial theory and the ways in which a multicultural society like Australia can embrace a new kind of citizen who isn't invested in the old colonial structures and can sort of change the society from within. Do you see that process of change happening in Australia and where do you think Indigenous Australians fit into that idea of diaspora?
The notion of diaspora, to me, is supposedly to address the issue around migrancy. So it's to, you know, so theorists kind of like moved in post-colonialism to develop strategies themselves to claim ground within the countries in which they found themselves located. And what I want to say in terms of Indigenous people is that we can be in and out of place. And what I mean by that is it's not it's like if I go down to, say, for example, Yorta Yorta country, I am out of place because that is not my country, yes? So I kind of, it's like if you can imagine this is like Europe in the sense of all the different nations, except we have a far more complicated system of land tenure and nationhood and protocols that existed around movement and where you could live, right? So you may be, I may be out of place there at one, in one sense, right, if I see that in one way, in Yorta Yorta country. But what Yorta Yorta would do is put me in place. So Yorta Yorta mob would then kind of go, okay, what's your totem? What's your Yorta? All right, I'll put you with these people. So you're connected. You're in place. Now, you may not have all the rights of the owners, but you are still given a place. I think that that's a different way to be than coming into Australia as a migrant and being told what your place is and being asked to sign up with the state through citizenship. But the fact is that this land upon which people have built their lives who have come here, it is not. It is still our land. We've never ceded our sovereignty.
It is land though, isn't it, or a continent across which Indigenous people have experienced a certain kind of migration, would you say, under government policies of removal where people were taken from country to country, language group to language group. And I wonder if there is a certain kind of migrant experience within Indigenous Australia that has something interesting, maybe something helpful to be said about it.
Let's, for example, look at the reserve systems in Queensland, right? And so we've still got areas where, like, say, Yarrabah, Cherbourg, that still exist. That's the production of colonialism. Now, whether or not that experience of being displaced from your country is the same, I would argue no, because most people, through oral tradition, in one shape or form, know where their bloodline to country is. And, yes, you are not in your country, but you're not in your country because of something the state did. So it's not a choice to be there. And you're not a refugee. So you're not a refugee, you're not a migrant. You're dispossessed peoples who've been placed on other people's lands. But the complication in that is people married in. So bloodline to country flowed even though people were outsiders, people were incorporated. Even in the reserve systems and stuff, people married in. And they did because relationality and is basically how we function in the world. And getting back to the thing with you were saying, being in place and being out of place, you know, it's like the cultural system here of being in and out of place speaks differently to me than what I read about diaspora and migrancy. Even though I would argue, like, migrancy and refugees are all kind of come out of usually a... especially for the coloured folk, you know, it's violence that produces the need to leave. And here it was violence that produced the reserve systems.
You don't, I understand, talk about Indigenous identity. Mm-hmm. This word identity is something that you take issue with. Yeah. Why is that?
Because identity, you know, and identification is part of the epistemological presuppositions that come out of enlightenment that underpin the way in which the West produces knowledge. So identity is something that's constructed through and by Western thought. And even like theories where people of colour, like for example Stuart Hall, has produced a theory of identity, his notion of identity really is not tied to land. Right, so identity in that sense becomes something that is flexible, can be acquired, it becomes a possession, right? So it's also something, supposedly, you can change like your socks. Whereas if you're grounded in the sense of there is only one place or places where you can be and that defines who you are, I don't get to choose. Your bloodline to country is not about choice. If the land identifies me and the people identify me and claim me and that is who I am, then self-identification for me becomes problematic. And it's even the notion of Aboriginality, like the Aboriginal is a concept constructed through a particular colonial discourse, you know. We were blacks, then we were natives, and then we became Aborigines in this country, right? So, you know, they became racialised identifiers of us.
Where does this leave the question of rights, though? Because, you know, we hear so much about Aboriginal rights, land rights, all, again, from an Enlightenment perspective, grounded in an identity of some sort or other.
Well, you know, rights itself comes out of a particular Enlightenment framework. But rights has become the discourse, like human rights, you know, Indigenous rights, land rights. That's the discourses that have come to be that we have been constituted by, through and with, because we don't have the power to control it. We have to speak to the coloniser in the terms which it understands, mirroring the dress, picking up the language, learning the etiquette, right? All of that are things that we have to do so that we can engage with you. It has never been the opposite.
So if we were going to leave terms like or concepts like identity and rights out of it, how would we talk about reconciliation, restitution, this sort of thing?
As soon as you say that to me, it's like, well, what are we reconciling? And how can we even think about reconciliation when we haven't even addressed anything really to do with it? I think white Australians need to reconcile with themselves about what happened in this country. You know, reconciliation in that sense to me is a white thing. And yet it's become a discourse by which Aboriginal people have been able to gain some place. For example, every university's usually got a reconciliation action plan, okay? Whereas for me, I want a whole of university approach and I want Indigenous stuff embedded in all of your core policy documents because Indigenous education is core business. I do not want to be in a reconciliation action plan on the side, which relies on goodwill. And if your vice chancellor changes, the goodwill could go out the window. It's not embedded structurally. It's on the periphery, like we're always on the periphery. So do I think that reconciliation is a wonderful thing? I think it really is about white Australia reconciling with its past.
And with its whiteness?
Well, it has to, because fundamentally this country was founded on race. It wasn't founded on culture in the sense of, you know, if we just get to know the Aborigines culture, then everything will change. No, what I want for white Australia to do is to actually look at itself and what culture it has. I mean, I've done interviews with white people about whiteness and I said, well, what's your culture? And honest, you just sit there and some people just say, oh, it's about white bread or, we've got the bush or, and I'm like, well, you know, if culture is everything that is transferred from one generation to the next non-biologically, then you're immersed in culture all the time.
Well, culture's something in white Australia that you buy, isn't it? I mean, it's commodified. It's, you know, you buy this book, you go and see some band or orchestra. I mean, that, I think to a lot of people, that's what culture would mean.
Yeah, it's consumptive possessive behaviour, right? But capitalism does that. It's a wage labour system based on the production of commodities for profit. That's what it is. And what it does is it sucks everybody into things more and more. We need to challenge enlightenment thinking. We need to think about the way we think about things. You know, so what happens if we centre Mother Earth at the centre of our theorising, but not in a relationship of extraction and consumption, but in a relationship of living with a living entity that sustains us, that being human fundamentally can only exist with her, and yet look at what we do to her, because we think as humans we are far more important. You know, we have more rights. We have all the rights in the world to do these things when we don't. We don't have a right to do that. But what have we actually destroyed and what have we done?
Well, I think we're finding out today, I mean, as we're having this conversation, the half the east coast of Australia is on fire.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think, you know, there are some things that I just don't understand. For people that had science on their side, look at the stupidity. And so how do you fundamentally reach out to products of the Enlightenment and capitalism? How do you say stop?
On RN, you've been listening to The Philosopher's Zone with Aileen Morton Robinson. She's Indigenous Elder Scholar in Residence at RMIT University in Melbourne. And that brings us to the end of Philosophy in the Wake of Empire. This has been a five-part series, and if you're just catching up on it, all the previous episodes are available via the ABC Listen app or via the RN website. Just look for The Philosopher's Zone on the program menu, and that will take you to streaming and download links, as well as more information about all of our guests and further reading. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm David Rutledge. You can find me on Twitter at David P. Zone, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.